dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, we continue with our series on the International Grassroots Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11. This program will focus on what are known as false flag operations, acts of violence performed covertly by one country or political faction, which is then blamed on another country or group in order to create a pretext for war, repression, or other state objective. Our speakers tonight will discuss some examples from history involving covert operations of this sort by the U.S. government, and they will place 9/11 within this context. Over the past several weeks, we've presented speakers examining the inconsistencies of the official story of 9/11. These inconsistencies, coupled with the obstructionism and documented series of lies and corrupt practices of the administration, ought to make any reasonable person conclude that some sort of cover-up is in progress. One response often heard at the suggestion that people within the U.S. government orchestrated or in some other way deliberately facilitated the 9/11 attacks is that such a conspiracy would need many people in the know and could not be kept a secret. Yet history has uncovered many such conspiracies that only come to light long afterward. The people who knew at the time either agreed with the plan, were afraid of losing their careers, their security clearances, or even their lives. One case in the memory of many listeners is that of the Gulf of Tonkin incident that was used as a pretext for the escalation of the Vietnam War and ultimately led to the deaths of more than 50,000 of America's young people, as well as the psychological and physical wounding of tens of thousands of others, not to mention millions of Vietnamese civilians. The official story was that North Vietnamese torpedo boats launched an unprovoked attack against a U.S. destroyer on a so-called routine patrol in the Tonkin Gulf on August 2, 1964, and that North Vietnamese PT boats followed up with a deliberate attack on a pair of U.S. ships 2 days later. The truth was very different. Rather than being on a routine patrol on August 2nd, the U.S. destroyer Maddox was actually engaged in aggressive intelligence-gathering maneuvers in sync with coordinated attacks on North Vietnam by the South Vietnamese Navy and the Laotian Air Force. On the night of August 4th, the Pentagon proclaimed that a second attack by North Vietnamese PT boats had occurred earlier that day in the Tonkin Gulf. A report cited by President Johnson as he went on national TV that evening to announce a momentous escalation in the war, airstrikes against North Vietnam. But Johnson ordered U.S. bombers to retaliate for a North Vietnamese torpedo attack that never happened. Prior to the U.S. airstrikes, top officials in Washington had reason to doubt that any August 4th attack by North Vietnam had occurred. Cables from the U.S. Task Force commander in the Tonkin Gulf, Captain John J. Herrick, referred to freak weather effects, almost total darkness, and an overeager sonar man who was hearing the ship's own propeller beat. One of the Navy pilots flying overhead that night was Squadron Commander James Stockdale, who gained fame later as a prisoner of war and then as Ross Perot's vice presidential candidate. "I had the best seat in the House to watch that event," recalled Stockdale more than 15 years after the fact. and our destroyers were just shooting at phantom targets. There were no PT boats there. There was nothing there but black water and American firepower. Perhaps an honest mistake by that administration. Well, Daniel Ellsberg, a consultant at the Pentagon, released a classified 7,000-page study on the decision-making surrounding the war in Vietnam beginning in 1945. Ellsberg was one of the people who had authored the study. In 1969, Ellsberg slipped a copy of the study to New York Times reporter Seymour Hersh, and the series of deliberate deceptions of the public by the government establishment was revealed. But here's a kicker. Ellsberg had given copies of the document to a Senate committee 2 years earlier, and the senators took no action to make public the deception. This is an interesting point, because at the time the president was a Democrat, and the Congress was dominated by Democrats as well. The inverse situation of the present, yet the results were the same. Then as now, the wars were desired by the establishment, the people who control the society and determine the meaning of the term national interest. Not coincidentally, an interest that parallels quite closely the personal and organizational fortunes of this economic and professional elite. The common thread is control of resources and the profits that flow therefrom. Though 9/11 was not a fabricated attack, the question of who perpetrated the attack and why are by no means settled. We think we know the identities of the 9/11 hijackers, but how do we know, except from official pronouncements by an administration that has been caught in an expanding web of lies? We go now to the International Inquiry on the Unanswered Questions of 9/11 from last March in San Francisco, California. Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA Radio's Guns and Butter program moderated this section of the conference, and she introduces the first speaker.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker. She's a friend of mine, a colleague. She's heard regularly on Guns and Butter, Maya Schoen. Maya Schoen, long active in political life, has been involved in international resistance to imperialism and the workers' movement in the United States. She is co-author with Ralph Schoenman of Prisoners of Israel and Homage to Palestine. She was a documentary filmmaker who, in the pioneering video collective Optic Nerve, produced and directed award-winning social issue documentaries. She was a newscaster and reporter at KPFK in Los Angeles. Her lecture slide presentation, The War in Lebanon, An Inside View, including her slides from the massacre of Palestinians and Lebanese in Sabra and Shatila, received worldwide attention. Today, she handles communication for professional and technical engineers, Local 21, and planning for elders. Maya Schoen's presentation tonight is Who's the Enemy Now? Please welcome Maya Schoen.
For those of you expecting Ralph Schoenman right now, as it says in the program, we're leaving the best for last. Also, in the program, it states that I'm going to be speaking about militarizing domestic rule. In other words, testing the waters, military rule in America. But I changed that too. You can learn more about military rule by listening to our programs, such as Testing the Waters, Military Rule in America, Police State America, or Treason at the Top. But after the bombings that took place in Madrid on March 11th, 911 days after the events of September 11th, I decided to speak about Who's the Enemy Now? Who's the Enemy Now is a headline that blared across Time magazine on the March 29th issue in an article by Johanna McCary. And in it she states, new networks of jihadists emerge faster than the United States and its allies can arrest or kill them. Counterterrorism experts believe that a new, more elusive generation of extremists, apparently inspired by Al-Qaeda's ruthless vision, men like Jamal Zugan, 30 years old, a cell phone salesman arrested for the Madrid bombings, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, 37 years old, the Jordanian suspected of orchestrating violence in Iraq, that these two have taken up the banner, and so have others like them. Barely recognizable, she continues, even to officials who make a living tracking terrorists, the new jihadists proved in Madrid that they can evade detection while they hatch their plots. And no one knows where they're going to strike next. So writes Johanna McCreary. And this is something that was orchestrated and played out throughout the press, whether you read the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Time Magazine, or Newsweek, striking fear and terror in the minds of people worldwide was more important to our capitalist rulers than any evidence. In fact, Jamal Zugan had stated that he was home asleep, and he had been tracked by intelligence agents in Europe since August 2001. And those loosely connected to him, such as the Syrian-born Abu Imad El-Din Barkas Yakers, known as Abu Dada, had been tried, actually, in Spain, but no evidence ever linked him to the events of 9/11. Now, across Time magazine, it stated, "Who's the enemy now?" And it discussed what had taken place in Madrid and what would take place worldwide. But if we look on the internet at the Israeli intelligence weekly, Debka, which we refer to often in Taking Aim, on February 25th, just a couple of weeks before, Debka wrote, "Al-Qaeda builds a Euro army." So the events of Madrid had the stage set by the article that appeared in Debka. And I quote now from Debka. "Warnings of Al-Qaeda's continuing threat came Tuesday, February 24th, from Washington and London, as well as by one of its top leaders. Addressing the Senate Intelligence Committee, CIA Director George Tenet spoke of the spread of Al-Qaeda's radical agenda to local groups who now threaten the United States and are capable of 9/11 scale attacks. British Interior Secretary David Blunkett announced new stringent measures throughout Great Britain to combat terror because, he said, a terrorist attack on Britain was, quote, inevitable. Now, the reason was clearly stated by Debka's title, Al-Qaeda builds a Euro army. Note, this is February 25th. And they explain, Al-Qaeda has been discovered by Debka's intelligence sources to be recruiting manpower in Europe at a brisk pace in a push into the continent personally advocated by Osama bin Laden. The European arena, continues Debka, is showing a dangerous dynamism. And this is what it shows in terms of the network of Al-Qaeda and other groups. According to French counterintelligence, Al-Qaeda has recruited in France alone between 35 and 45,000 men and is organizing them into military-style units. Remember, this is February 25th. They meet regularly for training in the use of weapons and explosives, combat tactics, and indoctrination, and are controlled from local and district command centers on the organization's National French Command. Note this, a National French Command for the Al-Qaeda network. Then we have Germany. Al-Qaeda, according to Debka, has recruited 25,000 to 30,000 men in Germany alone, plus the 35 to 45,000 in France, And then the British Domestic Intelligence Agency, MI5, states that there are 10,000 al-Qaeda operatives in Britain. And they state this is causing Blunkett ample concern. So we have 35 to 45,000 plus 30,000 plus 10,000, and this doesn't even count the Balkans. Because, Depka states, Italy itself doesn't have very many, and it doesn't have to, because the Balkan countries of Albania, Kosovo, and Macedonia are the source of weapons, money, false documents, and these go out to other European bases. And it continues, finally, by stating unknown numbers are being enlisted in Belgium, Switzerland, Holland, Sweden, and Norway. Add it all up, and you have over 100,000 new al-Qaeda terrorists throughout Europe. But it gets more serious. Recruitment across Europe, Depka says, continues apace and in greater secrecy than ever, because they are building a Euro army. But note, these are not Arabs. These are not people from Algeria. These are not people from Morocco. They are not from Saudi Arabia. These are native Europeans freshly converted to Islam. And it is called the White Recruitment Drive, or, quote, coffee shop conscription. Operational cells. I am telling you, this is straight from Israeli intelligence. Operational cells are recruiting these agents, and they patronize ordinary cafes on the high streets of Europe's major cities, where they blend into the crowds. Consider what this means if you're a European. It means anytime you go into a cafe and you look over your shoulder, who are you seeing really? None other than another of the white recruitment drive or the coffee shop conscription. Unit level meetings or training sessions are attended by 30 to 40 men. Imagine all this intelligence they have. And it takes place under the cover of social activity, such as holiday camps in the remote parts of Europe. Here we have, who is the enemy now? According to Depka, the enemy is everyone. Now, while Depka set the stage at the end of February for what was taking place in Madrid, the blueprint of Madrid was actually drawn up in Italy. And if we look particularly at events that took place 24 years before, we see something strikingly similar to what took place in Madrid on March 11th. At 10:25 a.m. on August 2nd, 1980, a powerful bomb exploded in the second-class waiting room at Bologna Railway Station. It was the height of the summer, it was the holiday season, and the station was crowded. 85 people were killed, 200 injured, in what was considered the worst atrocity in Europe since the end of World War II. 7 of the victims were children under the age of 15, and one of them was a girl of 3. The bombing in Bologna shocked the world, and particularly the people in Italy, much as the bombing in Madrid shocked the people of Spain. However, it was not a singular affair. 8 bomb attacks had taken place over a 15-year period, from December 12, 1969, similar bomb attacks, with the beginning of the bombing of the Banca Nazionale dell'Agricoltura in the Piazza Fontana in Milan, and 3 explosions that took place in Rome on the very same day, December 12, 1969. And these continued until the blowing up of a train, again a train, near Florence on December 23, 1984. If you look only at these train bombings, these 8 bomb attacks, and as investigators, investigating magistrates It did in Italy, and later a parliamentary commission. They all concluded that the violence was part of what was called a strategy of tension that was fostered and funded by the Italian secret services directly and by foreign secret services, notably the United States Central Intelligence Agency. The sole purpose was to prevent the rise of the Italian communist power, to prevent it from achieving power through the electoral process. Now, the Communist Party in Italy was the largest in Western Europe, and from 1972 to 1976, it came close to taking over from the Christian Democratic Party as the largest party in Italy, and with an alignment with the Socialist Party, could have made a bid to form a new government. But if you look at a progression of attacks that took place and the vast terror apparatus that was created by the CIA, Italian capitalists, and notably through their main party, the Christian Democratic Party, you note that in 1972, there were 595 attacks, and it rose to 1,353 attacks. These are terrorist assaults in Italy in 1976, and increased up to 2,513 in 1979, and then tapered down because people, as orchestrated through the press, believed that these were the work of the Red Brigades and other left groups. The early phase of the bombings, which lasted from until 1974, were indiscriminate bombings and not attributed. They were directed against the public, and they were later revealed to be in conjunction with a series of right-wing coup plots. Now, the principal purpose of all these bombings was to provide an excuse for military intervention, attributing responsibility, as I said, they did, to left-wing or anarchist groups, and then you would have the police and the Secret Service follow up on those leads. A good example took place in 1973. Then a notorious right-winger was caught as he injured himself handling a bomb that blew up in a train toilet. Now, he was not supposed to be caught. Before he was caught, he had walked up and down the train displaying a copy of Lotta Continua, Continuous Struggle, a left newspaper. This is very similar to what Lee Harvey Oswald was doing, holding a copy of a militant in that forged photo. So again, as the intelligence operation here in the United States tried to pin it on the left with a fake copy of Oswald, so we have in Italy an operative walking up and down the train with a copy of Lotta Continua. The strategy of tension was to promote chaos, to undermine the economy, and to create a situation of political tension, fear, and hostility. And it did. On October 31st, 1974, General Vito Micheli, then the head of Italian intelligence, was arrested on a charge of conspiring to overthrow the government by provoking an armed insurrection. He stated then that a parallel intelligence group had been formed under a secret agreement with the United States, and it was done within the framework of NATO. His co-conspirator, Lieutenant Colonel Amos Spiazzi, who was also in the Secret Service, the military Secret Service, when he later was arrested, many years later, he said that he had joined a right-wing group called Rosa dei Venti, Compass Rose, on the specific orders of his higher-ups in the Italian intelligence, then the SID. And let's look more closely at the CIA and its work with the various levels of Italian intelligence. This was kept secret and only came out until 1990, but most of it came out in 2000, only recently, when there was an Italian parliamentary commission, and it stated that all these events, this terror apparatus the right-wing paramilitary, and the infiltration into the Red Brigades had been going back to World War II and was pursued by every administration, be it Democratic Party or Republican Party, every administration. A top-secret memorandum of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, dated May 14, 1952, reveals the existence of the plan codenamed Demagnetize. Now, Demagnetize was designed specifically to lessen the influence of communist parties in both France and Italy. It had evolved from what was called the Stay Behind Network that had been created by CIA Director Alan Dulles, who saw a communist under every stone. And with the Stay Behind Network, he was going to build a secret anti-communist guerrilla force across Europe. To that end, a series of political, paramilitary, and psychological operations, now I'm quoting here now from this Joint Chiefs of Staff memo, it states specifically, to that end, a series of political, paramilitary, and psychological operations were to be employed, end quote. And the man charged with implementing the Italian end of this, which was the most active end because of the relation of forces with the Italian Communist Party, the man to head this was the head of Italian military intelligence at the time, General Giovanni Di Lorenzo, who later himself would be accused of a military coup in the summer of 1964. Who on the U.S. end was placed in charge of Demagnetize? At this end, it is someone who you know well. It was none other than William Colby. William Colby, who later became the CIA station chief in Saigon, Vietnam in 1959, developed there the Phoenix program, the horrible, notorious Phoenix program that he started in 1968, which was to take 55,000 lives, and some estimates have it up to 100,000 lives. And then he became the CIA director awarded for his efforts in Vietnam, and he was the director in 1973 until President Ford replaced him with none other than George Herbert Walker Bush. Colby was proud of what he did in Italy. He described it in his memoirs, how he was sent to Italy in the 1950s to run, quote, what was by far the CIA's largest covert political action program undertaken until then, or indeed since. Colby then states his specific task was, quote, to prevent Italy from being taken over by the communists in the 1958 elections and thus prevent NATO defenses from being circumvented by the PCI. In fact, Colby points out that it was the possibility of the Communist Party winning the 1948 elections 10 years earlier that led the United States to form the Office of Policy Coordination, which first set out the CIA's responsibilities and gave it the capability to take covert political propaganda and paramilitary operations in the first place. This is William Colby speaking. According to Di Lorenzo, who was the head of Italian intelligence, Colby himself ordered Di Lorenzo to plant microphones in the papal apartments and bugs in the office of the Italian president's official Rome residence, the Quirinale Palace. So it wasn't just to set up paramilitary groups, but it was to spy even on the Pope and the president of Italy. By 1956, a secret agreement between the U.S., the CIA, and the Italian military intelligence was formalized as Operation Gladio. And Gladio is the Italian word for a Roman short sword. There were 139 arms caches that were buried at secret locations throughout Italy, and training was done by British intelligence, and similar stay-behind networks were set up in most countries of Western Europe, including Austria, Yugoslavia, Belgium, Holland, Norway, Portugal, Finland, Sweden, and Switzerland. which was supposed to be neutral. Later, Rome Station Chief William Harvey himself described the plans of the CIA to destabilize the Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro, who at the time was attempting to reach an understanding with the Socialist and the Communist parties in order to offset their ability to win and to create a government on their own. Harvey suggested that Colonel Renzo Rocca, who was the director of military intelligence, changes names in Italy, it was now the SIFAR, their Office of Industrial Counterespionage. Harvey had said that the U.S. CIA proposed that Rocca use his, quote, action squads, these paramilitary groups that had been set up by the CIA and British intelligence, that they, quote, carry out bombings against the Christian Democrat Party offices and certain newspapers in the North, which were to be attributed to the left. Now, Harvey was in possession of lists containing more than 2,000 right-wingers belonging to these paramilitary groups who were available for use against the Communist Party and other left groups. We have to put this in perspective. It is not a secret cabal of intelligence operatives. In fact, Fiat, the largest industrial complex in Italy at the time, had extensive relations with CIFAR and used the military intelligence operatives to spy upon its own workforce and to disrupt union activities. It's also instructive to now examine where all these paramilitary groups were trained. And this, I'm going into what took place in Italy because it has direct bearing on what took place at 9/11 and what took place in Madrid, Bali, and elsewhere around the world. The rightists, the paramilitary rightists, as well as agents, these intelligence agents who were to infiltrate the Red Brigades and later were involved in the kidnapping and murder of Aldo Moro himself, they were trained at a secret NATO base near Capo Marghiu, on the west coast of Sardinia between 1969 and 1975. Now this base had been a small base that was upgraded and designed by American technicians. And many of the students had to be flown in by military aircraft from an airport outside Rome. They had to be flown in because this base was inaccessible by road. It was that secret. At the end of each course, the graduates were allowed to keep their weapons and explosives that they had been given upon arrival. 40 independent cells, it's estimated, each recruiting more people. So they had 622 leaders of these paramilitary cells, and they were to recruit at least 15,000 in all throughout Italy. Does this remind you of the Depka figures? It's important to understand that while the paramilitary right-wing troops were on the ground conducting these attacks and bombing, the leadership itself included people in the highest council of state and industry throughout Italy. For instance, the group P2, Propaganda 2, which is an Italian Freemason lodge, and had its Grand Master, Licio Gelli. He was a close friend of Juan Perón, and he also sat in the front rows of the inaugural ceremonies of President Ford, Carter, and Reagan, very closely tied to the United States presidents and the leadership here in the United States, and this is Licio Gelli. Now, I mentioned Licio Gelli particularly, but the membership list, which was later found in Gelli's apartment when it was raided in 1981, when you had these inter-rivalries, showed that 195 high-ranking officers from all branches of the military belonged to P2, and it included the head of the Domestic Secret Service and the head of military intelligence. Now, in the Independent in Great Britain, In November 16, 1990, remember I told you that a lot of this came out in 1991, Charles Richards and Simon Jones reported, quote, "Every member of the crisis committee set up by Francesco Cossiga, who was then the interior minister and later became the president of Italy in 1990, was a member of P2. At a trial of a neo-fascist, Vincent Vinciguerra, that took place in response to a 1972 attack that killed three Carabinieri, Vincent Vinciguerra stated at his trial, quote, "Every bombing in Italy, remember these 2,000 bombings in just one year, after 1969 was ordered by an apparatus belonging to the state, specifically a secret parallel structure of the Interior Ministry." Now let's go back to the Bologna bombing that killed 85 people in 1980. When there was finally a trial, and this trial was obstructed, the investigations that are done by magistrates in Italy, that investigation was obstructed by the intelligence services themselves. What emerged in the trial is that the makings of the bomb in the Bologna railway bombing came from a Gladio arsenal, and the event was linked to Lucio Gelli and the P2 network. The P2 network of the Freemasons that included people from the highest councils of state. It pointed the finger at the United States directly. As well, we have these intelligence operatives also pointing the finger at the United States. But if we look at this document of the Left Democratic Party, and we look at the people they interviewed, they state specifically the role of the CIA. Let's leave Italy for the moment, and let's go to Afghanistan. Again, we see the role of the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. capitalist ruling structure. In April of 1978, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, the PDPA, came into power. Now, the PDPA, for all you can say about it, was committed to radical land reform, trade union rights, expansion of education and social services, and equality for women. But what's most disturbing to the rulers in the United States was that the PDPA had close ties to the Soviet Union. Between 1978 and 1989, the U.S. waged a war against what President Ronald Reagan on March 8, 1985, later called the evil empire of the Soviet Union. Central to that was the destabilization of the USSR, and foremost in that game of destabilization was Afghanistan. The U.S. created what was called by Zbigniew Brzezinski a bear trap. And Zbigniew Brzezinski was Democratic Party U.S. President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. But this policy was also continued by Brzezinski's successors. The aim, as I said, was to destabilize and break up the Soviet Union. For Brzezinski, Afghanistan was the gateway to the oil-rich Central Asian republics, which were pivotal, the Central Asian republics, the stands, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all the stands, the republics of the Soviet Union. And they were pivotal because they were a source of oil. But he also considered that Central Asia, what he called the grand chessboard, was pivotal in a worldwide control of resources as well as a gateway to China. And so between 1978 and 1992, the U.S. government poured at least $6 billion, and some estimates are as high as $20 billion, worth of arms, training, and funds to prop up what were called the Mujahideen factions, to bring down the PDA government and to attack Soviet troops that attempted to prop it. Now, it wasn't just the United States. There were other Western governments, as well as Saudi Arabia, the U.S.'s closest ally at the time, and they provided millions more. The United States run Radio Liberty, as well as Radio Free Europe, beamed Islamic fundamentalist tirades across Central Asia. But what were they doing inside Afghanistan? And who were the players besides Zbigniew Brzezinski, the mastermind of it all? Washington's favorite was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who, you may have heard, in the 1970s was known for throwing acid in the faces of women who refused to wear a veil. And when the Mujahideen eventually took Kabul in Afghanistan in 1992, Hekmatyar's forces rained U.S.-supplied missiles and rockets on the city, killing at least 2,000 people. And he did it until the government agreed that he would be prime minister. Now, aside from the U.S. and Saudi funds, Hekmatyar also funded his operation through opium cultivation and trafficking. And within 2 years, the Afghanistan-Pakistan border became the world's single largest source of heroin, supplying 60% of all drug users in the United States. Now remember, this is through the CIA-sponsored Hekmatyar. In 1995, the former director of CIA's operation in Afghanistan described the explosion in the flow of drugs. Quote, "Our main mission was to do as much damage as possible to the Soviets. There was a fallout in terms of drugs, yes, but the main objective was accomplished. The Soviets left Afghanistan," end quote. In fact, this drug operation was critical to the destabilization because it provided vast amounts of funds, much more than could come through the secret accounts of the CIA directly, or the Defense Department, or through the allocations of Congress, much as you had with the Contra network, you had here in Afghanistan a vast drug network that was funding the operations of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, aside from Hekmatyar, who was key and influential to this operation? And I'm sure you know the answer. That was none other than Osama bin Laden, who came from the wealthy bin Laden family. The bin Laden family has the largest construction business in the world, and bin Laden was Hekmatyar's closest associate. Ahmed Rashid, a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review, described the plan in great detail in an article. In 1986, CIA Chief William Casey committed CIA support to a long-standing Pakistani intelligence plan. Now, the Pakistani intelligence is the ISI. And the plan was to recruit from around the world Mujahideen to join an Afghan jihad. At least 100,000 Islamic militants from 50 countries, according to this article in the Far Eastern Economic Review, flocked to Pakistan between 1982 and 1992, and 60,000 attended schools where they were trained by British MI6, SAS, that's the Special Air Service, known most of all for the terror operations it conducts for British imperialism in Northern Ireland. Now, the Muslims who were recruited from the United States, some went to Afghanistan, but others were sent to Camp Peary, the CIA's spy training camp right in Virginia. And there you had Afghans and Arabs from Egypt and Jordan, as well as African-American black Muslims. And they were taught sabotage skills, according to John Cooley, a former journalist with ABC Television Network and the author of unholy wars, Afghanistan, America, and international terrorism. The program was called Operation Cyclone. The U.S. operatives were recruited at the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Brooklyn, New York, and they were given paramilitary training in the New York area itself before they were sent to Afghanistan to join Hekmet Yar's forces and Osama bin Laden's forces. Now, in Pakistan, the money and the equipment for these Mujahideen factions was distributed by a new organization called the Maktab al-Khidmat, the Office of Services, the MAK, and it was run by the ISI directly with three people in charge, one of whom was Osama bin Laden, and by 1989 he was given overall control of the MAK. Now remember, this is Pakistan intelligence, British intelligence, and most of all, the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States, who primarily was directing the operations. One of the trainers in 1989 was Ali Mohammed, who happens to have been a Green Beret. Now, I mention specifically Ali Mohammed because his name again appears in 1998, because he was one of the people, the so-called terrorists, charged with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya and Tanzania. Also trained by Ali Mohammed, the U.S. Green Beret, was El Said Nosar, who was tried with others for plotting to bomb New York landmarks, including the World Trade Center. This is a trial that took place after 1993. In 1986, to go back to bin Laden, he brought heavy construction equipment from Saudi Arabia to Afghanistan, because remember, the family is the largest construction company in the world, and he has close ties with the construction equipment. And he himself is an engineer, and he used his knowledge to construct the training camps that are funded through the drug money and run by British intelligence and the CIA. And these are the camps that, in the invasion of Afghanistan, the heavy camps that were dug deep into the sides of mountains that the U.S. sent its bunker-busting bombs to destroy. The very training camps built by the United States. The mercenaries, these people sent to destabilize Afghanistan, and destabilize Afghanistan they did. We must reiterate over and again that they were armed by the CIA. They were armed by the CIA directly and indirectly through the opium traffic. Pakistan, the United States, and Britain provided military trainers, and as well, they received funding for all this armament from the U.S. close ally and collaborator, Saudi Arabia. Tom Carew, a former British SAS soldier, who fought with the Mujahideen, told the August 13, 2000 British Observer, quote, "The Americans were keen to teach the Afghans the techniques of urban terrorism, car bombing, and so on, so they could strike at the Russians in major towns," end quote. By 1987 to 88, bin Laden changed the name of his organization to Al-Qaeda, the military base. And Vincent Canestrano, the former CIA chief of counterterrorism operations, comes into play at this point. Canestrano had been in charge of the CIA-backed Nicaraguan Contras during the early 1980s, and he was assigned by the National Security Council to use his expertise in Afghanistan. He was made the supervisor of covert aid to the Afghan Mujahideen. As the Wall Street Journal commented, quote, "The Taliban are the players crucial to serve the country as a prime transshipment route for the export of Central Asia's vast oil, gas, and natural resources," end quote. Now, let's go back to Who's the Enemy Now in Time magazine. because it ends quite appropriately. In the darkened warrens of the United States counterterrorism agencies, and we have to note that these are now collaborative agencies because President Bush set up the Terrorist Threat Integration Center in the hold of the CIA Counterterrorism Center. To return to the quote, the pace is unrelenting. As analysts try to disrupt the terrorists before they can strike here in the United States, those officials are intensely worried that Islamists, emboldened by the Spanish vote, are focusing on how to target the United States in the run-up to Election Day, to blow up public confidence in the Bush administration. Officials warn that this summer's Democratic and Republican conventions in Boston and New York City present exactly the kinds of targets Al-Qaeda teaches its operatives to choose. The crush of VIPs, chaos, noise, and the long hours will be a security nightmare. And as a senior U.S. official points out with a shudder, both conventions will be held above train stations. It didn't take Time magazine and it didn't take DEPCA. On November 23, 2003, David Rothkopf, who had been the Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce and in charge of international trade policy in the Clinton administration, and is now a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, wrote an article that appeared in the Washington Post called Terrorist Logic Disrupt the 2004 Election. And he said, quote, recently I co-chaired a meeting hosted by CNBC of more than 200 senior business and government executives, many of whom are specialists in security and terrorism-related issues. Almost three-quarters of them said it was likely the United States would see a major terrorist strike before the end of 2004. A similar number predicted that the assault would be greater than those of 9/11 and might involve weapons of mass destruction. These are serious people, notes Rothkopf, not prone to hysteria or panic. They're military officers, policymakers, scientists, and researchers who've studied these issues for a long time. Now, Rothkopf also notes, when we go to the polls next November, it will be 25 years after Iranian militants captured U.S. diplomats in Tehran and began the hostage crisis that dominated the 1980 election and helped bring down President Jimmy Carter. But what Rothkopf doesn't mention is that the events around that hostage crisis, key to them was George Bush Sr. and Osama bin Laden's father, who, in an event called the October Surprise, prevented the release of the hostages and so affected the election of Jimmy Carter. I want to end on one note, and that takes us back to testing the waters military rule in America and leads into what Ralph will be talking about. Because these ominous warnings were also made by General Tommy Franks in the December issue of Cigar Aficionado, a 25-page interview. And Franks was the top commander during 1991 Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, and in charge of CENTCOM, overseeing the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq in 2003. And he described what he called the worst thing that can happen. Quote, the potential of a weapon of mass destruction, and he states specifically it could be chemical, biological, or a nuclear device, and a terrorist massive casualty-producing event somewhere in the Western world, it may be in the United States of America, that causes our population to question our own constitution and to begin to militarize our country in order to avoid a repeat of another mass casualty-producing event, which, in fact, then begins to potentially unravel the fabric of our Constitution. End quote. We need to ask ourselves, just as Time magazine did, who is the enemy now? But the question I pose that there, I mean, the question, the answer to that is different for me, and I'm sure it is for you. The enemy to the capitalist rulers is you and me. We are the enemy for capitalism. As they attack our rights, as they attack our standard of living, they are also planning to attack our ability to organize in our self-interest. They do this against labor unions, and they do this against our civil rights, be it with the Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, or any of the other laws that both this Democratic and Republican Congress pass time and time again. These ominous warnings are meant to terrorize us, and the terror apparatus that they construct, as I've demonstrated both in Italy and in Afghanistan, is a terror network that they fabricate, that they set up, that they fund, that they control. And it has one purpose, as it did in Italy, as it did in Afghanistan, and as it does here in the United States. It is to prevent our self-organization, is to prevent us from having control over our daily lives. But we are the many, and they are the few. And with our knowledge, and most importantly, with our collective organization, we shall overcome, and we shall be victorious.
Maya Shum, labor activist and co-host of WBAI's Taking Aim program, speaking last March at the International Inquiry on 9/11 in San Francisco. Taking Aim has a website, www.takingaim.info, takingaim.info. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
If you knew the earth was dying, if they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse, if you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes, if you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide, if you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts, what if you knew? Bombs were falling, if they showed them hit the ground, if you could see the bodies flying, if you could hear the sound, if you could see the rubble where the hospital once stood, if you saw the child's lifeless limbs, would you hold them if you could? If you knew that they were lying every time they spoke, for every laser-guided pinprick there were lives lost in the smoke, if instead of just the generals they had doctors too to describe the carnage of the cluster bombs, what if you knew? They were saying when they think you cannot hear, if you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear, if you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse, if you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes, every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs, if you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew? You knew that you were living in a huge conspiracy. Would you leave your suburbs, get out of your SUV? Would you hit the streets and fight for all our lives? Would you hold your ground when the stormtroopers arrive? If you knew that the whole planet depended on what you do now, would you take a man with the speed our times allow? If the pundits told the truth for just a week or two and real life was shown on TV, what if you knew?